4. I did not find him at home till past 7 o'clock that evening. To my surprise, he had visitors with him. Alexei Nilitch and another gentleman I hardly knew, one Shigalov, the brother of Virginsky's wife. This gentleman must, I think, have been staying about 2 months in the town. I don't know where he came from. I had only heard that he had written some sort of article in a progressive Petersburg magazine. Virginsky had introduced me casually to him in the street. I had never in my life seen in a man's face so much despondency, gloom, and moroseness. He looked as though he were expecting the destruction of the world, and not at some indefinite time in accordance with prophecies which might never be fulfilled, but quite definitely, as though it were to be the day after tomorrow at 10:25. We hardly said a word to one another on that occasion, but had simply shaken hands like two conspirators. I was most struck by his ears, which were of unnatural size, long, broad, and thick, sticking out in a peculiar way. His gestures were slow and awkward. If Liputin had imagined that a phalanstery might be established in our province, this gentleman certainly knew the day and the hour when it would be founded. He made a sinister impression on me. I was the more surprised at finding him here, as Shatov was not fond of visitors. I could hear from the stairs that they were talking very loud, all three at once, and I fancy they were disputing. But as soon as I went in, they all ceased speaking. They were arguing, standing up, but now they all suddenly sat down, so that I had to sit down too. There was a stupid silence that was not broken for fully 3 minutes. Though Shigalov knew me, he affected not to know me, probably not from hostile feelings, but for no particular reason. Alexei Nilitch and I bowed to one another in silence, and for some reason did not shake hands. Shigalov began at last looking at me sternly and frowningly, with the most naive assurance that I should immediately get up and go away. At last Shatov got up from his chair, and the others jumped up at once. They went out without saying good-bye. Shigalov only said in the doorway to Shatov, who was seeing him out, "Remember that you are bound to give an explanation." "Hang your explanation! And who the devil am I bound to?" said Shatov. He showed them out and fastened the door with the latch. "Snipes," he said, looking at me, with a sort of wry smile. His face looked angry, and it seemed strange to me that he spoke first. When I had been to see him before, which was not often, it had usually happened that he sat scowling in a corner, answered ill-humouredly and only completely thawed and began to talk with pleasure after a considerable time. Even so, when he was saying good-bye, he always scowled and let one out as though he were getting rid of a personal enemy. "I had tea yesterday with that Alexei Nilitch," I observed. "I think he's mad on atheism." "Russian atheism has never gone further than making a joke," growled Shatov, putting up a new candle in place of an end that had burnt out. "No, this one doesn't seem to me a joker. I think he doesn't know how to talk, let alone trying to make jokes. Men made of paper. It all comes from flunkeyism of thought," Shatov observed calmly, sitting down on a chair in the corner and pressing the palms of both hands on his knees. "There's hatred in it, too," he went on after a minute's pause. "They'd be the first to be terribly unhappy if Russia could be suddenly reformed, even to suit their own ideas, and became extraordinarily prosperous and happy. They'd have no one to hate then, no one to curse, nothing to find fault with. There is nothing in it but an immense animal hatred for Russia, which has eaten into their organism. And it isn't a case of tears unseen by the world under cover of a smile. There has never been a falser word said in Russia than about those unseen tears," he cried, almost with fury. "Goodness only knows what you're saying," I laughed. "Oh, you're a moderate liberal," said Shatov, smiling too. "Do you know," he went on suddenly, I may have been talking nonsense about the flunkeyism of thought. You will say to me, no doubt, directly, it's you who are the son of a flunkey, but I'm not a flunkey. I wasn't dreaming of such a thing. What are you saying? You need not apologize. I'm not afraid of you. Once I was only the son of a flunkey, but now I've become a flunkey myself, like you. Our Russian liberal is a flunkey before everything, and is only looking for someone whose boots he can clean. What boots? What allegory is this? Allegory, indeed. You are laughing, I see. Stepan Trofimovitch said truly that I lie under a stone, crushed but not killed, and could do nothing but wriggle. It was a good comparison of his. Stepan Trofimovitch declares that you are mad over the Germans, I laughed. We've borrowed something from them anyway. We took 20 kopecks, but we gave up 100 rubles of our own. We were silent a minute. He got that saw lying in America. Who? What saw? I mean Kirillov. I spent 4 months with him, lying on the floor of a hut. Why, have you been in America? I asked, surprised. You never told me about it. What is there to tell? The year before last, we spent our last farthing, 3 of us, going to America in an emigrant steamer to test the life of the American workmen on ourselves, and to verify by personal experiment the state of a man in the hardest social conditions. That was our object in going there. Good Lord, I laughed. You'd much better have gone somewhere in our province at harvest time if you wanted to make a personal experiment instead of bolting to America. We hired ourselves out as workmen to an exploiter. There were 6 of us Russians working for him. Students, even landowners coming from their estates, some officers too, and all with the same grand object. Well, so we worked, sweated, wore ourselves out. Kirillov and I were exhausted at last. Fell ill, went away, we couldn't stand it. Our employer cheated us when he paid us off. Instead of $30, as he had agreed, he paid me 8 and Kirillov 15. He beat us, too, more than once. So then we were left without work, Kirillov and I, and we spent 4 months lying on the floor in that little town. He thought of one thing, and I thought of another. You don't mean to say your employer beat you? In America? How you must have sworn at him. Not a bit of it. On the contrary, Kirillov and I made up our minds from the first that we Russians were like little children beside the Americans, and that one must be born in America, or at least live for many years with Americans to be on a level with them. And do you know, if we were asked $1 for a thing worth a farthing, we used to pay it with pleasure, in fact with enthusiasm. We approved of everything, spiritualism, lynch law, revolvers, tramps. Once, when we were travelling, a fellow slipped his hand into my pocket, took my brush, and began brushing his hair with it. Kirillov and I only looked at one another, and made up our minds that that was the right thing, and that we liked it very much. The strange thing is that with us, all this is not only in the brain, but is carried out in practice, I observed. Men made of paper, Shatov repeated. But to cross the ocean in an emigrant steamer, though, to go to an unknown country, even to make a personal experiment and all that, by Jove, there really is a large-hearted staunchness about it. But how did you get out of it? I wrote to a man in Europe, and he sent me 100 rubles. As Shatov talked, he looked doggedly at the ground, as he always did, even when he was excited. At this point, he suddenly raised his head. "Do you want to know the man's name?" "Who was it?"
"Nikolai Stavrogin."
He got up suddenly, turned to his limewood writing table, and began searching for something on it. There was a vague, though well-authenticated, rumour among us that Shatov's wife had at one time had a liaison with Nikolai Stavrogin in Paris, and just about 2 years ago, that is, when Shatov was in America. It is true that this was long after his wife had left him in Geneva. If so, what possesses him now to bring his name forward and to lay stress on it, I thought. I haven't paid him back yet, he said, turning suddenly to me again and looking at me intently as he sat down in the same place as before in the corner and asked abruptly, in quite a different voice, "You have come, no doubt, with some object. What do you want?" I told him everything immediately, in its exact historical order, and added that, though I had time to think it over coolly after the first excitement was over, I was more puzzled than ever. I saw that it meant something very important to Lizaveta Nikolaevna. I was extremely anxious to help her, but the trouble was that I didn't know how to keep the promise I had made her, and didn't even quite understand now what I had promised her. Then I assured him impressively once more that she had not meant to deceive him, and had had no thought of doing so, that there had been some misunderstanding, and that she had been very much hurt by the extraordinary way in which he had gone off that morning. He listened very attentively. "Perhaps I was stupid this morning, as I usually am. Well, if she didn't understand why I went away like that, so much the better for her." He got up, went to the door, opened it, and began listening on the stairs. "Do you want to see that person yourself?"
"That's just what I wanted. But how is it to be done?" I cried, delighted.
"Let's simply go down while she's alone. When he comes in, he'll beat her horribly if he finds out we've been there. I often go in on the sly. I went for him this morning when he began beating her again."
"What do you mean?"
I dragged him off her by the hair. He tried to beat me, but I frightened him, and so it ended. I'm afraid he'll come back drunk and won't forget it. He'll give her a bad beating because of it."
We went downstairs at once. The Lebyadkins' door was shut, but not locked, and we were able to go in. Their lodging consisted of two nasty little rooms, with smoke-begrimed walls on which the filthy wallpaper literally hung in tatters. It had been used for some years as an eating-house, until Filipov, the tavern-keeper, moved to another house. The other rooms below what had been the eating-house were now shut up, and these two were all the Lebyadkins had. The furniture consisted of plain benches and deal tables, except for an old armchair that had lost its arms. In the second room there was the bedstead that belonged to Mademoiselle Lebyadkin, standing in the corner, covered with a chintz quilt. The captain himself went to bed anywhere on the floor, often without undressing. Everything was in disorder, wet and filthy. A huge, soaking rag lay in the middle of the floor in the first room, and a battered old shoe lay beside it in the wet. It was evident that no one looked after anything here. The stove was not heated, food was not cooked. They had not even a samovar, as Shatov told me. The captain had come to the town with his sister, utterly destitute, and had, as Liputin said, at first actually gone from house to house begging. But having unexpectedly received some money, he had taken to drinking at once, and had become so besotted that he was incapable of looking after things. Mademoiselle Lebyadkin, whom I was so anxious to see, was sitting quietly at a deal kitchen table on a bench in the corner of the inner room, not making a sound. When we opened the door, she did not call out to us, or even move from her place. Shatov said that the door into the passage would not lock, and it had once stood wide open all night. By the dim light of a thin candle in an iron candlestick, I made out a woman of about 30, perhaps, sickly and emaciated, wearing an old dress of dark cotton material, with her long neck uncovered, her scanty dark hair twisted into a knot on the nape of her neck, no larger than the fist of a 2-year-old child. She looked at us rather cheerfully. Besides the candlestick, she had on the table in front of her a little peasant looking-glass, an old pack of cards, a tattered book of songs, and a white roll of German bread, from which one or two bites had been taken. It was noticeable that Mademoiselle Lebyadkin used powder and rouge and painted her lips. She also blackened her eyebrows, which were fine, long, and black enough without that. Three long wrinkles stood sharply conspicuous across her high, narrow forehead, in spite of the powder on it. I already knew that she was lame, but on this occasion she did not attempt to get up or walk. At some time, perhaps in early youth, that wasted face may have been pretty, but her soft, gentle grey eyes were remarkable even now. There was something dreamy and sincere in her gentle, almost joyful expression. This gentle, serene joy, which was reflected also in her smile, astonished me after all I had heard of the Cossack whip and her brother's violence. Strange to say, instead of the oppressive repulsion and almost dread one usually feels in the presence of these creatures afflicted by God, I felt it almost pleasant to look at her from the first moment, and my heart was filled afterwards with pity, in which there was no trace of aversion. "This is how she sits, literally for days together, utterly alone, without moving. She tries her fortune with the cards or looks in the looking-glass," said Shatov, pointing her out to me from the doorway. "He doesn't feed her, you know. The old woman in the lodge brings her something sometimes out of charity. How can they leave her all alone like this with a candle?" To my surprise, Shatov spoke aloud, just as though she were not in the room. "Good day, Shatushka," Mademoiselle Lebyadkin said genially. "I've brought you a visitor, Marya Timofyevna," said Shatov. "The visitor is very welcome. I don't know who it is you've brought. I don't seem to remember him." She scrutinized me intently from behind the candle, and turned again at once to Shatov, and she took no more notice of me for the rest of the conversation, as though I had not been near her. "Are you tired of walking up and down alone in your garret?" she laughed, displaying two rows of magnificent teeth. "I was tired of it, and I wanted to come and see you." Shatov moved a bench up to the table, sat down on it, and made me sit beside him. "I'm always glad to have a talk, though you're a funny person, Shatushka, just like a monk. When did you comb your hair last? Let me do it for you." And she pulled a little comb out of her pocket. "I don't believe you've touched it since I combed it last."
"Well, I haven't got a comb," said Shatov, laughing too.
"Really? Then I'll give you mine. Only remind me, not this one, but another." With a most serious expression, she set to work to comb his hair. She even parted it on one side, drew back a little, looked to see whether it was right, and put the comb back in her pocket. "Do you know what, Shatushka?" She shook her head. "You may be a very sensible man, but you're dull. It's strange for me to look at all of you. I don't understand how it is people are dull. Sadness is not dullness. I'm happy."
"And are you happy when your brother's here?"
"You mean Lebyadkin? He's my footman, and I don't care whether he's here or not. I call to him, 'Lebyadkin, bring the water,' or 'Lebyadkin, bring my shoes,' and he runs. Sometimes one does wrong and can't help laughing at him."
"That's just how it is," said Shatov, addressing me aloud without ceremony. "She treats him just like a footman. I've heard her myself calling to him, 'Lebyadkin, give me some water,' and she laughed as she said it. The only difference is that he doesn't fetch the water but beats her for it. But she isn't a bit afraid of him. She has some sort of nervous fits almost every day, and they are destroying her memory so that afterwards she forgets everything that's just happened and is always in a muddle over time. You imagine she remembers how you came in? Perhaps she does remember, but no doubt she has changed everything to please herself. And she takes us now for different people from what we are, though she knows I'm Shatushka. It doesn't matter my speaking aloud. She soon leaves off listening to people who talk to her, and plunges into dreams. Yes, plunges. She's an extraordinary person for dreaming. She'll sit for 8 hours, for whole days together in the same place. You see, there's a roll lying there. Perhaps she's only taken one bite at it since the morning, and she'll finish it tomorrow. Now she's begun trying her fortune on cards.
I keep trying my fortune, Shatushka, but it doesn't come out right,
Marya Timofyevna put in suddenly, catching the last word, and without looking at it, she put out her left hand for the roll. She had heard something about the roll, too, very likely. She got hold of the roll at last, and, after keeping it for some time in her left hand, while her attention was distracted by the conversation which sprang up again, she put it back again on the table unconsciously, without having taken a bite of it.
"It always comes out the same. A journey, a wicked man, somebody's treachery, a deathbed, a letter, unexpected news. I think it's all nonsense, Shatushka. What do you think? If people can tell lies, why shouldn't a card?"
She suddenly threw the cards together again.
"I said the same thing to Mother Praskovya. She's a very venerable woman. She used to run to my cell to tell her fortune on the cards without letting the Mother Superior know. Yes, and she wasn't the only one who came to me. They sigh and shake their heads at me. They talk it over while I laugh. Where are you going to get a letter from, Mother Praskovya, I say, when you haven't had one for 12 years? Her daughter had been taken away to Turkey by her husband, and for 12 years there had been no sight nor sound of her. Only I was sitting the next evening at tea with the Mother Superior. She was a princess by birth. And there was some lady there, too. A visitor, a great dreamer. And a little monk from Athos was sitting there, too. A rather absurd man, to my thinking. What do you think, Shatushka? That monk from Athos had brought Mother Praskovya a letter from her daughter in Turkey that morning. So much for the Knave of Diamonds. Unexpected news. We were drinking our tea, and the monk from Athos said to the Mother Superior, 'Blessed Mother Superior, God has blessed your convent above all things in that you preserve so great a treasure in its precincts,' said he.
'What treasure is that?' asked the Mother Superior.
'The Mother Lizaveta, the Blessed.'
This Lizaveta the Blessed was enshrined in the nunnery wall, in a cage 7 feet long and 5 feet high, and she had been sitting there for 17 years in nothing but a hempen shift, summer and winter, and she always kept pecking at the hempen cloth with a straw or a twig of some sort. And she never said a word, and never combed her hair or washed for 17 years. In the winter they used to put a sheepskin in for her, and every day a piece of bread and a jug of water. The pilgrims gaze at her, sigh and exclaim, and make offerings of money.'
'A treasure you've pitched on,' answered the Mother Superior. She was angry. She disliked Lizaveta dreadfully. 'Lizaveta only sits there out of spite, out of pure obstinacy. It is nothing but hypocrisy.' I didn't like this. I was thinking at the time of shutting myself up, too. 'I think,' said I, 'that God and nature are just the same thing.' They all cried out with one voice at me. 'Well, now,' the Mother Superior laughed, whispering something to the lady, and called me up, petted me, and the lady gave me a pink ribbon. 'Would you like me to show it to you?' And the monk began to admonish me. But he talked so kindly, so humbly and so wisely, I suppose. I sat and listened. 'Do you understand?' he asked. 'No,' I said. 'I don't understand a word, but leave me quite alone.' Ever since then they've left me in peace, Shatushka. And at that time, an old woman who was living in the convent doing penance for prophesying the future whispered to me as she was coming out of church, 'What is the Mother of God? What do you think?' 'The Great Mother,' I answer, 'the hope of the human race.' 'Yes,' she answered, 'the Mother of God is the Great Mother, the damp earth, and therein lies great joy for men, and every earthly woe and every earthly tear is a joy for us, and when you water the earth with your tears a foot deep, you will rejoice at everything at once, and your sorrow will be no more. Such is the prophecy. That word sank into my heart at the time. Since then, when I bow down to the ground at my prayers, I've taken to kissing the earth. I kiss it and weep. And let me tell you, Shatushka, there's no harm in those tears. And even if one has no grief, one's tears flow from joy. The tears flow of themselves, that's the truth. I used to go out to the shores of the lake. On one side was our convent, and on the other the pointed mountain. They called it the peak. I used to go up that mountain, facing the east, fall down to the ground, and weep and weep. And I don't know how long I wept, and I don't remember or know anything about it. I would get up and turn back when the sun was setting. It was so big and splendid and glorious. Do you like looking at the sun, Shatushka? It's beautiful but sad. I would turn to the east again, and the shadow of our mountain was flying like an arrow over our lake, long, long and narrow, stretching a mile beyond, right up to the island on the lake and cutting that rocky island right in two, and as it cut it in two, the sun would set altogether, and suddenly all would be darkness, and then I used to be quite miserable. Suddenly I used to remember. I'm afraid of the dark, Shatushka. And what I wept for most was my baby.
Why, had you one? And Shatov, who had been listening attentively all the time, nudged me with his elbow.
Why, of course, a little rosy baby with tiny little nails, and my only grief is I can't remember whether it was a boy or a girl. Sometimes I remember it was a boy, and sometimes it was a girl. And when he was born, I wrapped him in cambric and lace, and put pink ribbons on him, strewed him with flowers, got him ready, said prayers over him. I took him away unchristened, and carried him through the forest, and I was afraid of the forest, and I was frightened. And what I weep for most is that I had a baby, and I never had a husband.
"Perhaps you had one," Shatov queried cautiously.
"You're absurd, Shatushka, with your reflections. I had. Perhaps I had. But what's the use of my having had one, if it's just the same as though I hadn't? There's an easy riddle for you. Guess it," she laughed.
"Where did you take your baby?"
"I took it to the pond," she said with a sigh. Shatov nudged me again.
"And what if you never had a baby, and all this is only a wild dream?"
"You ask me a hard question, Shatushka," she answered dreamily, without a trace of surprise at such a question. "I can't tell you anything about that. Perhaps I hadn't. I think that's only your curiosity. I shan't leave off crying for him anyway. I couldn't have dreamt it."
And big tears glittered in her eyes.
"Shatushka, Shatushka, is it true that your wife ran away from you?"
She suddenly put both hands on his shoulders and looked at him pityingly.
"Don't be angry. I feel sick myself. Do you know, Shatushka, I've had a dream. He came to me again. He beckoned me, called me. 'My little puss,' he cried to me. 'Little puss, come to me.' And I was more delighted at that little puss than anything. He loves me, I thought."
"Perhaps he will come in reality," Shatov muttered in an undertone.
"No, Shatushka, that's a dream. He can't come in reality. You know the song. 'A new fine house I do not crave. This tiny cell's enough for me. There will I dwell, my soul to save, and ever pray to God for thee.' Ah, Shatushka, Shatushka, my dear, why do you never ask me about anything?"
"Why, you won't tell. That's why I don't ask."
"I won't tell, she answered quickly. "You may kill me. I won't tell. You may burn me. I won't tell. And whatever I had to bear, I'd never tell. People won't find out."
"There, you see. Everyone has something of their own," Shatov said, still more softly, his head drooping lower and lower.
"But if you were to ask, perhaps I should tell. Perhaps I should," she repeated ecstatically. "Why don't you ask? Ask me nicely, Shatushka. Perhaps I shall tell you. Entreat me, Shatushka, so that I shall consent of myself. Shatushka, Shatushka."
But Shatushka was silent. There was complete silence, lasting a minute. Tears slowly trickled down her painted cheeks. She sat, forgetting her two hands on Shatov's shoulders, but no longer looking at him.
"Ah, what is it to do with me? And it's a sin."
Shatov suddenly got up from the bench.
"Get up!"
He angrily pulled the bench from under me and put it back where it stood before.
"He'll be coming, so we must mind he doesn't guess it's time we were off."
"Ah, you're talking of my footman,"
Maria Timofeyevna laughed suddenly.
"You're afraid of him. Well, goodbye, dear visitors. But listen for one minute, I've something to tell you. That Nilitch came here with Filipov, the landlord, a red beard, and my fellow had flown at me just then. So the landlord caught hold of him and pulled him about the room, while he shouted, 'It's not my fault. I'm suffering for another man's sin.' So would you believe it? We all burst out laughing."
"Ah, Timofeyevna, why, it was I, not the red beard. It was I pulled him away from you by his hair this morning. The landlord came the day before yesterday to make a row. You've mixed it up."
"Stay. I really have mixed it up. Perhaps it was you. Why dispute about trifles? What does it matter to him who it is gives him a beating?" she laughed.
"Come along," Shatov pulled me. "The gate's creaking. He'll find us and beat her."
And before we had time to run out onto the stairs, we heard a drunken shout and a shower of oaths at the gate. Shatov let me into his room and locked the door.
"You'll have to stay a minute if you don't want a scene. He's squealing like a little pig. He must have stumbled over the gate again. He falls flat every time."
We didn't get off without a scene, however.